were they talking about? Well, the means were in fact being used. They weren't just being talked about. They were being used in fact prior to this. They were using, for example, such means as U.S. support for armies fighting inside the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, armies that had been established and encouraged by Hitler, which were now being supported with CIA agents and airdrops and so on. This also involved things like turning over West German intelligence to a network run by Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of Nazi military intelligence in the Eastern Front. So reconstitute the Nazi network for the Eastern Front. These were the measures that were already in place prior to the NSC 68. All of this is known in the United States, but considered insignificant. We might react a little bit differently, let's say, if we found that the Soviet Union in 1950 was supporting armies in the Rockies established by Hitler and dropping agents and supplies to them. But we consider it our right, since we own the world, we consider it our right to do anything anywhere, whereas others plainly don't have equivalent rights. So that's the hardline extreme, and notice that the policies were being implemented. Well, let's turn to the doves. Let's turn to the other extreme. The leading dovish figure was undoubtedly George Kennan. He headed the State Department planning staff until 1950, at which time he was replaced by Paul Nitze. That was a switch from the dovish to the hawkish extreme of the spectrum. Kennan was one of the major figures in shaping the post-war world. He's also one of the most humane and intelligent and also lucid of state planners, and therefore what he wrote is extremely interesting to illustrate the dovish extreme. I've sampled the hawkish extreme. For example, one document which you ought to look at if you want to understand your country is PPS 23, Policy Planning Study 23, published by the State Department planning staff, written by George Kennan, top secret, of course, February 1948. Here's what it says. I'll now quote it. We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives, such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we're going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. Now, that, of course, is a top-secret document. To pacify the public, it's necessary to trumpet the idealistic slogans, as is done constantly. But here, planners are talking to one another. Now, these prescriptions, in fact, referred to the Far East, but the United States is a global power, and the same principles apply elsewhere, as Kennan and others explained. So, for example, in a briefing for Latin American ambassadors in 1950, Kennan observed that a major concern of U.S. foreign policy must be, I'm quoting, the protection of our raw materials. Notice, our raw materials. Again, this is secret, so you can be open about it. To protect our resources, we have to combat a dangerous heresy which had been detected by U.S. intelligence shortly before and which they said was spreading through Latin America, namely, quote, the wide acceptance of the idea that the government has direct responsibility for the welfare of the people. That's what's called communism. Whatever the political commitments of the advocates, they can be church-based self-help groups or whatever, but they're communists if they fall under this heresy. Again, another term of newspeak. Well, Kennan went on to explain the means that we have to use against our enemies who fall prey to this heresy that threatens our resources, which happen to be in their countries. Quote, the final answer might be an unpleasant one, but we should not hesitate before police repression by the local government. This is not shameful, since the communists are essentially traitors. It's better to have a strong regime in power than a liberal government if it is indulgent and relaxed and penetrated by communists. Again, the term communist being used in the technical sense. Remember, I'm sampling the dovish side of the spectrum here. Well, these views illustrate the spectrum of opinion among planners, and the documentary record pretty well falls within that spectrum, as you can discover by checking it. Occasionally, you can find some qualifications. So, for example, there's an influential study of April 1947, secret again, which observed that, about aid, it observed that foreign aid should be restricted to countries of, I'm quoting now, countries of primary strategic importance to the United States, excepting in those rare instances which present an opportunity for the United States to gain worldwide approbation by an act strikingly humanitarian. Now, this stance, again, is not unique to the United States, and it did not arise in the post-war period. So let's return to Woodrow Wilson, who, as you know, was the great apostle of self-determination, and who celebrated this doctrine by invading Mexico and invading Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where his warriors murdered and destroyed, reestablished virtual slavery, demolished the political system, while establishing the basis for murderous and corrupt dictatorships, and placed the area firmly into the hands of U.S. investors. Well, Kennan's nutshell presentation of U.S. foreign policy did not emerge from a vacuum. It reflected a much broader geopolitical analysis that had been developed by elite groups and planning studies through the war. There were study groups of the State Department, including virtually all their top planners, and the Council on Foreign Relations, which provides the main business input into foreign policy planning through the war, 1939 to 1945, and they formulated kind of a theory of what the post-war world should look like. They formulated the concept of what they called the grand area, a region which they said should be subordinated to the needs of the American economy. It should include the Western Hemisphere, the Far East, the former British Empire, which was being dismantled and subordinated to the United States. It was to be extended to a total global system, if possible, surely including Western Europe and the incomparable energy resources of the Middle East, which were then passing into American hands as we pushed out our rivals, France and England. Now, these guiding geopolitical conceptions explain a good deal of what has been happening in the world. If they're not understood, what takes place will appear to be a series of random errors, inconsistencies, confusions, traceable to the failings of a political leadership that is in fact succeeding quite brilliantly in its assigned chores. The Third World was to be incorporated within the grand area, so was Europe. Europe posed problems, but Soviet aggression was considered a very remote eventuality. The CIA concluded in 1947 that the problem of Europe was not Soviet aggression, which no intelligence expected, but rather the possibility of economic collapse in Western Europe and the consequent accession to power of communist elements. It's one reason for the Marshall Plan, which was also motivated by the needs of U.S. industry for export markets and overseas investment. That came out of Kennan's office, incidentally. Let me just note that the United States, contrary to what everyone says, left and right, contrary to what virtually everyone says, the United States achieved its major objectives in Indochina. That was a partial victory for the United States. No successes in Indochina will infect the region. The kind of economic and social development that American planners were very much afraid of in the late 1950s and early 60s, particularly in South Vietnam, and remember, South Vietnam was the main target of the American attack throughout, and the United States won its war against South Vietnam. No successes there will infect the region. And post-1975 U.S. policy has, in fact, been designed to maximize repression and suffering in the countries that were devastated by U.S. violence. The degree of the cruelty of this is quite astonishing if you look at the details. For example, when the Mennonites tried to send pencils to Cambodia, the State Department stopped them. When Oxfam tried to send 10 solar pumps, government stopped them. When religious groups tried to send shovels to Laos to try to dig up some of the unexploded ordnance left by the American bombing, the government tried to stop them. When India tried to send 100 buffalo to Vietnam to replace the huge buffalo herds that were destroyed by the American attack, and remember, this is a primitive country. Buffaloes means fertilizer, tractors, and so on. The United States threatened to cancel food for peace aid. That's one that Orwell would have appreciated. Meanwhile, while the United States was extirpating the cancer at its source, the threat of successful development in South Vietnam and elsewhere at its source, it buttressed what was called the second line of defense, for example, by supporting the Suharto takeover in Indonesia with some 500,000 killed in a few months in 1965, backing the overthrow of Philippine democracy in 1972, supporting martial law in South Korea, again in 1972, again under Carter in 1980, and so on. Well, in accordance with the reigning geopolitical conceptions, right at the end of World War II, the United States turned at once to dealing with the problem faced, with a major problem faced by the population of the world, which had been politicized by the war, namely the problem faced by the anti-fascist resistance. The anti-fascist resistance in the liberated regions had to be suppressed, and the United States turned to that task globally, often suppressing it in favor of Nazi and fascist collaborators. This, in fact, is a major theme of early post-war history, which is barely discussed. It ought to be chapter one in an honest history of the post-war period, but you really have to look into the technical monographs to find it. What was the problem? Well, the primary concern is one that had been formulated by one of Winston Churchill's closest advisors, Jan Christian Smuts, South African prime minister. He pointed out to Churchill in 1943 that with politics let loose among those peoples, we may have a wave of disorder and wholesale communism set going all over those parts of Europe. Communism, again, in the technical sense. Neither so-called communism nor socialism nor national capitalism was tolerable, and they had to be destroyed. The pattern was set in the first area liberated, North Africa, where President Roosevelt installed in power Admiral Jean Darlan, who was a leading Nazi collaborator and the author of the Vichy anti-Semitic laws. As U.S. forces advanced through Italy, they restored the essential structure of the fascist regime and dispersed the resistance, which had fought courageously against six Nazi divisions. In Greece, the United States entered under the guise of the Truman Doctrine, launching the first major post-World War II war of insurgency, a very murderous war with maybe 160,000 killed, complete with torture, political exile for tens of thousands of people, re-education camps, as we called them, for tens of thousands of others, destruction of unions and any political independent politics, and the full range of means that were later used in similar exercises throughout the world, placing the country firmly in the hands of U.S. investors and local business elites, while in fact much of the population had to emigrate in order to survive. The beneficiaries again included Nazi collaborators, while the primary victims were the workers and the peasants of the communist-led anti-Nazi resistance. Well, the same pattern was followed elsewhere. It was a global pattern. A fascist coup in Colombia, which was inspired by Franco's Spain, aroused no concern in the United States, no more than a military coup in Venezuela or the restoration of an admirer of fascism in Panama. But the first democratic government in the history of Guatemala, which modeled itself on Roosevelt's New Deal, elicited bitter U.S. antagonism, and a CIA coup that turned Guatemala into a literal hell on earth, kept that way since, with regular U.S. intervention and support, particularly under Kennedy and Johnson, and including the Carter years, when, contrary to what is commonly alleged, U.S. military aid never ceased and was barely below the norm. Under Reagan, support for near genocide in Guatemala became positively euphoric, and the most extreme of these series of Guatemalan Himmlers that we backed there, Rios Montt, was lauded by Reagan as a man totally dedicated to democracy who was getting a bum rap, also lauded by Elliot Abrams, Gene Kirkpatrick, and other enthusiastic supporters of Pol Pot-style atrocities, which is in fact what was going on there at the time, with maybe 75,000 people slaughtered and others tortured and raped, etc., during that period, a couple of years. One aspect of this post-war project of suppressing the anti-fascist resistance, often in favor of fascist collaborators, one aspect of it was the recruitment of war criminals, people like Klaus Barbie. He had been responsible, the Butcher of Lyon, as he's called. He was responsible for many crimes in France, so he was naturally placed in charge of spying on the French for U.S. intelligence. The reasons for this were cogently explained by Barbie's superior, Colonel Eugene Kolb of U.S. intelligence. He noted that Barbie's skills were badly needed, he said, I'm quoting, "To our knowledge, his activities had been directed against the underground French Communist Party and the resistance, just as we in the post-war era were concerned with the German Communist Party and activities inimical to American policies in Germany." That's right. The comment is quite apt. The United States was picking up where the Nazis had left off, and it was therefore entirely natural that they should employ specialists in anti-resistance activities. Later on, when it became difficult or impossible to protect these useful folk in Europe, many of them were spirited off to the United States or to Latin America with the help of the Vatican and fascist priests. There they have engaged in terrorism, coups, the drug and armaments trade, training the apparatus of the U.S.-backed national security states modeled on the Nazis in Latin America, training them in methods of torture devised by the Gestapo, and so on. Some of their students have found their way to Central America, establishing a direct link between the death camps and the death squads via the U.S.-SS post-war alliance. Now, I can't run through the whole record case by case, but let me mention a few general points. We might ask how well George Kennan's precepts were followed. Recall George Kennan, the dovish advice, again in top secret documents, that in order to maintain the disparity, we put aside all concern for vague and unrealistic ideas such as human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. How well have we lived up to that? Well, it's an empirical question, and it has indeed been studied. So if you take human rights, there are studies relating the human rights climate to American aid, and there's a correlation, impressive correlation. Let me quote from Lars Schultz, who's the leading U.S. academic specialist on human rights in Latin America. He discovered in one study that U.S. aid has tended to flow disproportionately to Latin American governments which torture their citizens, to the hemisphere's relatively egregious violators of fundamental human rights. Furthermore, he shows the correlation is strong, includes military aid, extends through the Carter years, and is unexplained by any relation between aid and need. These facts, you might think, would be of some concern to people who care about their country. Let's turn to the raising of the living standards. Now, quite regularly, in areas of predominant U.S. influence, such as Latin America, there has been statistical growth in the course of what are called economic miracles, while much of the population starves, as croplands are diverted to export production for the benefit of U.S. agribusiness and local elites. That's true throughout Central America. Kennedy's Alliance for Progress gave a significant impetus to these destructive, in fact, if we were honest, murderous developments. And there's a corollary to the Kennedy Alliance for Progress style of development. It's necessary to institute terror and torture states with an efficient apparatus of repression to suppress the popular opposition that develops when you pursue such development policies. The structure of the death squads in El Salvador, for example, was established at that time. Countries that have attempted to reverse the pattern, such as Guatemala under the democratic capitalist regime of Arevalo and Arbenz, or the Dominican Republic under the also democratic capitalist regime of Bosch or Nicaragua today, naturally they are the target of U.S. hostility and violence. As for democratization, the historical record reveals exactly what a rational observer would expect. If you look at the case of, say, Guatemala in 1954, where a democratic capitalist government was overthrown by a CIA coup, or 1963, when Kennedy backed a military coup to prevent the threat of renewed democracy, or Chile or the Dominican Republic in 1963 or 1965, and many others, you will discover that U.S. elites have consistently opposed formal parliamentary democracy if its results cannot be controlled. And they have evinced outright hatred for democracy at home as well, incidentally, if by democracy we mean a system that allows the mass of the population to participate in some meaningful way in the formation of state policy. These facts, incidentally, have not gone unnoticed by serious scholars. Well, the recent history of the United States in Central America illustrates all of these themes. Let me just mention some obvious truths. The real reasons for the attack against Nicaragua are explained by the charitable development organization Oxfam, the major charitable development organization which works in many parts of the Third World. Oxfam America points out that among the four countries of Central America where Oxfam America works, namely El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. Only in Nicaragua has a substantial effort been made to address inequities in land ownership and to extend health, educational, and agricultural services to poor peasant families. But the Contra war has slowed the pace of social reform and compounded the burden in the countryside, leading to hunger and a return to earlier conditions, so that now Americans who are enthusiastic supporters of starvation and torture can point to those failures as a justification for further atrocities, as they regularly do. This was all a major success for the United States. Well, let me just say a word about security policy since it's late, and I don't want to leave the topic unmentioned. The Pentagon system has long been the technique by which the state mobilizes public resources to subsidize advanced sectors of industry. Now, there are very good reasons, which business elites, incidentally, have articulated very clearly since the late 1940s, as to why these methods are to be preferred over other devices of public subsidy for so-called private enterprise. Contrary to what's often said, the beneficiaries are not primarily military industry, rather general high-technology industry. So take, say, computers, the foundation of any modern society. In the 1950s, when computers were not commercially marketable, they were paid for by the public. The public paid for the cost of the costly period of research and development and early production through the military system in the 1950s. In the 1960s, when computers became marketable, it was handed over to so-called private enterprise, which had already been subsidized so that they could make the profits. And that continues right now. So the so-called fifth generation computers, next big computer development, that's funded virtually entirely by the public through the Pentagon, NASA, which is basically a Pentagon-related enterprise, and the Department of Energy in connection with the production of nuclear weapons. And the same is true of a wide range of other advanced technologies. Now, if you understand these things, you can very well understand and predict, in fact, U.S. policies on arms control and related matters. The comparative advantage of the United States is not production any longer, rather technological innovation. Now, it's sometimes argued that this planning is lunatic, and it's true, but it's totally irrelevant. In government, as in business, it's a short-range system. You don't have long-term planning. The longer term is someone else's concern. If you think about it, you'll notice that that's quite natural in a competitive society, where those who do not devote themselves to short-term advantage are unlikely to be around in the long run. And these same attitudes are taken over when the same corporate managers become state planners. So we should not at all be surprised at the fact that in the 1950s, the United States made no effort to terminate the development of ICBMs, which were the only weapons that could threaten it. These factors are not the concern of planners. Rather, their concern is to maintain the disparity, to prevent rotten apples from infecting others, to ensure the crucial right to rob and to exploit, and to guarantee the domestic system of public subsidy and private profit called free enterprise. Now, the public may express overwhelming support for a nuclear freeze and cuts in military rather than social spending, as in fact it does, but this too is an irrelevance, as is the clear feasibility of a nuclear freeze, a comprehensive test ban, a ban on missile testing, and other measures which would surely enhance the possibilities of survival and be very beneficial to the security of the United States. As every serious study of the American political system recognizes, the public has little voice in such matters, and public opinion is of no more concern to elite groups that control the state apparatus than security or survival or human rights, the raising of the living standards, and democratization. Not only the people of Latin America, but also those of the rest of the world, including the United States, are an incident, not an end, in the words that so impressed Woodrow Wilson. This is not because the leadership are bad people, and none of it is likely to change very much if better people take their place. The reasons are institutional, and the problems should be confronted without illusions, with understanding of the social realities. Thank you.
You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on The Right Turn. This classic from the AR Archives was recorded at the University of Colorado in Boulder in 1986. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar-activist, has been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. During Alternative Radio's 40th anniversary year, we'll be airing more Chomsky classics from our archives. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent, unembedded nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on the Right Turn, and for his book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Foreign Policy Endangers the World, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Birdnote. It's a warm morning in the tropical rainforest. You grab your binoculars and scan the thick canopy. But you're not spotting any birds. Just lots of green leaves and a tree stump. Hold up. That tree stump isn't a tree stump at all. It's a bird. Common pottoos are champions of camouflage. In the daytime, these nocturnal creatures perch perfectly still on branches, heads pointed upward, bodies outstretched, and eyes closed down to tiny slits. With their cryptic coloration of brown, splashes of gray, and black spots, it's hard to tell where the branch ends and the bird's body begins. It's a wondrous adaptation to avoid predators. They're birds more often heard than seen, with a melodious but mournful song made at dawn, dusk, and by the light of the moon. The song earned pottoos the name Poor Me One in Trinidad and Tobago. At dusk, common pottoos awaken and take flight. They use their large yellow-orange eyes, long wings, and wide mouth to sally from a perch and gulp down flying insects. At the end of the night shift, pottoos return to their branches to hide in plain sight for another day. For BirdNote, I'm Joanne Ryan.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.